Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston in association with the BBC World Service and PRI.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Talk show host Rush Limbaugh is defending his comparison of the Obama administration's proposed health care reform and Hitler's Nazi Germany. This week, a swastika appeared on the office of a Georgia congressman who supports the proposed reform, and more than one town hall protester has drawn a line from the Obama plan to Nazi euthanasia. But yesterday on his syndicated show, Limbaugh said, "When you mention Hitler, everyone says, 'Oh, you can't say that. Nobody is as bad as Hitler.'" Then went on to say this.
"Let me make a point. The Nazis were National Socialists. Forget the genocide here. That came toward the end of what they were doing. They got started in the mid-30s and actually a little prior to that. They were not liberty-loving individuals. They were not for small, decentralized government anywhere. They were not for honest capitalism. They were National Socialists, and it was National Socialism and the view of big government and the idea that the some were better than others, which led to that monstrous genocide."
Well, University of Pennsylvania medical ethicist Arthur Kaplan wrote a column yesterday, he says, prompted by Rush Limbaugh's remarks. Arthur, you say the remarks muddy the water on health care, but they do something far worse in your mind. What is that?
It's Holocaust denial, and I say that deliberately, intentionally. There are two ways to be a denier about the Holocaust. One, to say it didn't happen. Rush Limbaugh and the right-wing chorus that's picked up this Nazi analogy in health reform don't say that. But the other is to deny why it happened. And why it happened is very simple. Racism. It has nothing to do with economics. It has nothing to do with socialism. It has everything to do with the racism that permeated German science starting in the 1890s.
And as you write, Hitler set out to kill the handicapped, the mentally ill, and he did so to protect the genetic future of Germany, also killed gays, gypsies, anyone who didn't fit the perfect model of genetic health. And you're saying that in Rush Limbaugh talking about socialism as being the reason for the Holocaust, he's denying that it was racism that was the reason.
Precisely. So the Holocaust is not some product of socialism. The Holocaust is a product of racism. And to say otherwise is to be a denier, a virulent and vile denier, because what you're trying to do is turn the Holocaust into something that was a function of a political ideology that was disconnected from gross, scurrilous racism. Doctors, medicine, and hospitals were not dragged into the Nazi Party by Hitler. They led the way through their racism.
So what happens in your mind when Rush Limbaugh says, yeah, but put aside the genocide and compare socialism to Barack Obama's health care plan?
Well, you know, it's one thing when somebody gets angry in the heat of a debate and says, I think Nancy Pelosi said something like, these town halls are like brown shirts coming in. Somebody said that on the Democrat side. That's not an appropriate reference either, but it was sort of in the heat of the moment. The right-wing crowd led by Rush has been all week constantly saying what happened in Germany is what's going to happen here if we pass health reform. And I consider that gross, immoral fear-mongering.
Well, I heard you lay out your case last night on Michael Smerkarnis' radio show, after which a caller called in and said you had it all wrong, that Limbaugh was only saying that Obama was making a power grab just like Hitler made a power grab.
And I've had plenty of emails from my column that echo that or that start saying, you know, it wasn't us who started the Nazi thing. Here's my response. Get the Nazi analogy out of this debate. I don't care who criticizes health reform. I don't care who goes to town meetings and yells about it. I really don't. Say what you want about that. Take the Nazi stuff and kick it to the curb. It doesn't belong in this debate. It doesn't have any analogies to this debate. When the Nazis get involved in euthanasia, it has nothing to do with cost containment. It has everything to do with killing people they felt to be inferior and threats, if you will, to their race.
Well, you note that conservative columnist David Brooks said on Meet the Press that he thought that people like Limbaugh or Sarah Palin making a connection between Obama and Hitler are insane. You've said you think it's maybe more thought through than that. What do you say to the people on the left and the right who say this is a minority voice, and in even talking about it, we're giving it more of a platform?
I think that you have to address it and call it to account whenever it occurs. I think people have to be sensitive to the temptation to fall into this Nazi analogizing. It happened in the stem cell research debate in this country. It happens in the abortion debate in this country. It is rhetoric that subtly shapes and drives the debate, and it has to be identified for what it is, historical distortion and denial.
Ethicist Arthur Kaplan of the University of Pennsylvania will link you to his column at our website, hereandnow.org. Arthur, thanks for speaking with us.
Hey, thanks for having me.
And by the way, tomorrow on Here and Now, we want to address questions you might have about health care reform that haven't been able to rise above the town hall shouting matches. If you've got a question, send it to letters@hereandnow.org. Well, read the headlines and the conclusions are obvious. This week, Newsweek writes, "While the West slumps, China's economy has quickly sprung to life." Other articles also point to a power shift from the West to the East. Not so fast, Minxin Pei's essay in Foreign Policy magazine cautions. Minxin Pei is senior associate at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. He's also professor of government and director of the Keck Center for International and Strategic Studies at Claremont McKenna College in California. So, Professor, let's lay it out. And you start out by arguing that even at current growth rates, Asia is nowhere near closing its economic gap with the West because, you write, for instance, it'll take the average Asian 77 years to reach the income of the average American?
Oh, yes, because Asia is growing fast, but at the same time, Asia is growing from a relatively low base. So if you look at per capita income, for Asia today, it is roughly $5,000. For the U.S., it's almost $50,000. So there is a 10-to-1 gap at the moment. And so if you assume that Asia will continue to grow at the current fast pace, which is very unlikely, and the U.S. will continue to grow at a relatively slow pace, it will take that long just for Asia to catch up with the U.S. in terms of per capita income.
Well, but, you know, some might say, but the cost of living is so much lower, so they don't need the salaries. And then just in the real broader view, I'm sure some people are thinking, wait a second, China alone owns almost all of the U.S. debt, you know, over $1 trillion in U.S. debt. So walk us through your thinking. Let's start with your idea that ideas are a crucial ingredient of clout. What ideas have you seen in the past can you trace coming from the West that you don't see coming from the East?
Well, the most basic ideas that define the international order today, such as the United Nations, multilateralism, international liberalism, human rights, and so-called international public goods, all these ideas originated in the West. Of course, the very idea of capitalism and free market economy originated from the West. So if you look at the big ideas that govern or influence our thinking about the world, none of them comes from the East.
What big ideas do come from the East, though?
Well, I cannot think of any at the moment.
Really?
Even though I'm Asian, and I really cannot think of any big ideas, sort of mega ideas that instantly change the way we think or lies at the very heart of how we view the world.
And how the world interacts with each other, at least through the economy. And you point out that another roadblock to Asia rising, if you will, has to do with addressing the big idea of pollution and the environment. You write, Asia's environmental challenges are huge. Air pollution already kills 400,000 people a year in China. It's that kind of a stumbling block that you see to Asia truly rising?
Oh, absolutely. Probably this is the most serious because Asia is a very crowded and overcrowded, I would say, continent. China, India alone make up 40% of the world's population. So the pressure on the natural resources, on the environment is huge. And if you assume that these two countries alone will grow at their current growth rates, the demand on energy, on water, on clean air will be simply phenomenal. Yeah. And then you see the future constraints on their growth.
Some of the things you list as roadblocks, political instability within the larger Asian countries like India and China. And you also say that things that might appear in the moment as an advantage, like the high savings rate in China, Chinese save far more than Americans, could also be a measure of weakness. How so?
High savings rate is good for developing countries in general because it finances investment, which drives economic growth. But if you have excessively high savings rate, then you have a problem because it shows that people have to save in order to prepare for an uncertain future. In the case of China, people save because they don't have social safety nets. For example, they don't have adequate health insurance. They don't have pension plans. That actually means a relatively weak social institutional structure. And that kind of country has to save, which means also that their average living standard is depressed because of the fear to consume.
And it's money that they may be saving, but they're not going to spend it on, for instance, buying things. That would drive the economy. They're going to spend it on taking care of themselves in their old age.
Also, I want to ask how they invest their savings. And when you look at that, you have to laugh because Asia in general, and China in particular, is investing in American Treasury bonds. American Treasury bonds are going to depreciate in the long run because the U.S. is running a very high fiscal deficit and the dollar is going to lose value in the long run.
Well, you know, that raises a question because one of the other things you list is that Asia, China in particular, depend on an export economy. They depend on exporting things to sell to the U.S. Americans are not buying as much because they can't afford it because of our economic crisis. And I'm wondering if maybe there's a parallel reality conversation going on in Asia right now with Asians talking about, see, the U.S. isn't the economic threat that we thought it was.
Well, of course, the Asians are talking about American decline while the Americans are talking about Asia's rise. My article is to introduce some balance into this debate or into this discussion because perhaps the Asians are looking at the American economic difficulties in a too pessimistic way while we are exaggerating Asia's potential.
Well, we talked about, as you said, one of the problems that you see in Asia is a lack of ideas. Another key Asian weakness you note, innovation and education. Start with innovation. Why do you see a weakness there?
Asian students are among the most hardworking, talented, and overachieving people we've seen. But at the same time, we find this paradox. How come Asia, with so much talent, native talent, has not been at the cutting edge of innovation? And if you look at the number of people who have been awarded the Nobel Prize, only 8 went to Asia.
Okay, well, what about Sony? Stay right there, Professor, because we want to have more with Min-Chin Pei, who, as you're hearing, is challenging the conventional wisdom that Asia is on the rise as the West is waning. We'll ask him about Sony, the Japanese electronics behemoth. Also later today, the business environment in Iraq. A double suicide bombing there today killed at least 17 people. But we're going to speak with a businessman who's trying to make it in Baghdad in spite of the risks. He's opening a nightclub. Also, before we go, we'll have the music of rock and Broadway star Stu. But we'll be back in a minute with Professor Pei here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, dedicated to accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science worldwide, on the web at mathworks.com.
Welcome back to Here and Now and our conversation today with Min-Chin Pei, whose essay in Foreign Policy magazine questions the general assumption that Asia is rising as the West is falling. Pei is a senior associate at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace and professor of government at Claremont McKenna College. So, Professor Pei, you were speaking before the break about innovation and ideas, big ideas, coming from the West, not the East. But there's a perception, and I'm thinking of Sony, as I said, that Asians at least were at the forefront of innovation. You're saying you don't see the proof of that.
No, because Sony is a great example. 20 years ago, even 15 years ago, Sony was feared to be taking over the U.S. It bought Columbia Pictures. And today, when you look at Sony, it's a struggling company. It cannot compete with Apple. Its Walkman is now probably collecting dust in various dustbins, while iPod has become the rage. That has a lot to do with the cultural differences between Asia and the U.S. The U.S. encourages independent thinking, critical thinking, which means that you always challenge the authorities. and you try to unseat the reigning authority in terms of ideas and technology. In Asia, there is this excessive deference and respect for authority. The culture there is much more hierarchical. And most importantly, in the U.S., it's decentralized. This dynamic and creative urge comes from within society. In Asia, the government is too dominant. Important universities, the best universities, are owned, run, financed by the government, and they are bureaucracies. In the U.S., on the other hand, most of the best universities are private universities, and they are much more dynamic and competitive.
Well, this falls under the heading of dictatorship has given Asia an advantage, which is, you say, a misperception?
Oh, yes. China's rise at the moment, and of course, 30 years ago, the rise of Korea, the rise of Taiwan, Singapore's economic prosperity have given people the perception that in East Asia, at least, one-party dictatorships have done enormous good in terms of economic growth. And it is easy to draw the conclusion that dictatorships perhaps are necessary for producing fast-paced economic growth because they are more efficient, they don't argue among themselves, they can make quick decisions. I would say this is totally, completely untrue, because if you look at the entire region, you find that East Asia and the entire Asia has both high-achieving dictatorships and very poorly performing dictatorships.
Well, just returning to the idea of education and innovation for just a moment, you write China supposedly graduates 600,000 engineers a year, India another 350,000, the U.S. only graduates 70,000, but if you look closer at those statistics, and that's what you're asking people to do, look closer at what we think we know, you say reports find that most of those engineers in India and China, human resources managers in international companies won't hire them.
Oh, absolutely, because in the U.S., engineers go through rigorous training. In India and China, most so-called engineers receive only what we might call an associate degree. So you cannot really consider them American standard engineers. So the absolute number of engineers being graduated is very small, half if not third of the number people tend to use. And then you look at how employers view their Indian and Chinese recruits. Here the picture is even more bleak. In India, no more than 15% to 20% of the graduates from colleges can be considered hireable by an international company. In China, the number is 10%.
Hmm. Well, and one of the last points you make is that we're talking about myths about Asia rising. And let's face it, 20 years ago, most people would have been thinking of Japan. Today, they're thinking largely of either India or more than likely China. And you say that China is unlikely to come to dominate Asia, even if it does become the continent's strongest power, which leaves an important role for America in that region for the foreseeable future. But why do you think China, as we watch it become so strong, we've ticked off a lot of reasons, but why else won't it, in effect, be allowed to be the dominating factor in the region?
First, internally, China faces severe challenges in terms of so-called national cohesion. It has large areas inhabited by ethnic minorities that don't want to be Chinese. So China will have to devote a great deal of resources pacifying and controlling these areas. Recently, we had an explosion of ethnic tensions in the northwestern part of China. And if you look at regionally, China has very strong neighbors, India, Japan, Russia. None of them would like to see China become the region's dominant power. So these countries will work either with each other or more likely with the U.S. to contain China's rise or to constrain China's ability to influence regional geopolitics. And that means that China will not be able to dominate East Asia.
That's Minxin Pei. He's senior associate at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, also professor of government and director of the Keck Center for International and Strategic Studies at Claremont McKenna College. His article in Foreign Policy magazine is entitled "Think Again, Asia's Rise. Don't Believe the Hype About the Decline of America and the Dawn of a New Asian Age. It'll be decades before China, India, and the rest of the region take over the world, if they ever do." And I just, one last thought, Professor. What do we do with this information other than, you know, I can see for some Americans there's a little sort of gloating factor, you know, but what do we do with this information?
First of all, relax. Second is focus on our own problems. Do not let our energy be diverted by an obsession with a third party or with another country, and then let envy take over our emotions. Rather, we should deal with our problems at home in the most calm and constructive and productive way.
Professor, thanks so much.
You're most welcome.
And as usual, we'd love to hear your thoughts on this or any story on the program. Just to go to hereandnow.org, up on the top there, you can click on Contact Us to send an email or make a phone call. Or you can scroll down and click on Leave a Comment and leave a comment right there on the homepage. We'd love to hear from you. Still ahead today, Passing Strange has gone from the stage to the screen and been given the Spike Lee treatment. We'll speak with Stu, the frontman for the indie band The Negro Problem, who stars in it. Here and Now. Where can you get an Obama-rita, a Bobama, the first dog, T-shirt, or jigsaw puzzles of the first family? Well, on Martha's Vineyard. Ever since news broke that the Obamas would be spending the last week of August on the island off Cape Cod here in Massachusetts, shop owners have been creating Obama-centric merchandise. The Vineyard Gazette is all over the story, even tracking down a bevy of Secret Service agents living out of a Winnebago. Julie Wells is editor of the Gazette. Julie, the Clintons famously and very publicly vacationed on the Vineyard. Are people expecting the same kind of public visit from the Obamas? And what's the mood on the island?
Well, I think the mood is upbeat. People are in a welcoming mood here on the Vineyard, and there's a lot of the usual fun, T-shirts and hats and a dog parade being planned. I do think that there's a sense that it's a little quieter, this presidential vacation and this visit. There are no public events planned. When the Clintons were here, there was a lot of activity, and they were out every 5 minutes. Certainly he was out getting ice cream and jogging and couldn't sit still. The Obamas are planning to stay in a private compound in Chilmark. And the sense that we have, they would like some downtime and would like some quiet time.
We're wondering if some of the, the low-key-ness of the visit has to do with the fact that the economy is still struggling. And there's a huge and heated debate over health care. Maybe there's a sense that the president wants to downplay his time off.
I think there probably is a sense of that, but the president may really want to have some time off. This is his first vacation as president, which I stopped to think about for a minute the other day. But he has come to the Vineyard before, and he said himself when he was here 2 years ago that he comes here because it's a place where he can wander around in his shorts and not shave in the morning and no one talks about it.
Well, that may not happen this time around, but
I think that may not. But
it's also a place that has a thriving and longtime African-American community.
Yes, it does.
That I believe I remember began during the Underground Railroad.
It did.
Right.
It dates way back, really back to the origins of the Vineyard as a summer resort. I think it was the first middle and upper middle class black summer colony in the United States.
Well, meantime, the T-shirts, the mugs, the puzzles are flying out the door, as we understand.
Yes, they are.
Do you have a favorite?
Oh, the Bobama. How can you resist for the dog?
Bo is the Portuguese water dog that the first family has, so he now has his own T-shirt.
At the dog store in Oak Bluff, that seems to be the hands-on favorite right now.
Is the island seeing this as good for business?
I think they are. The Vineyard has been affected by the recession, as every place else has. It's been an off summer here. It's been raining all summer. We hope the sun is going to come out when the Obamas come. But I think that people are expecting an uptick. But again, it doesn't feel huge. It doesn't feel like there's an onslaught. There's not, you know, this rush into the place that there was when the Clintons came. Also, it's important to say that they're coming late. The exodus off the island really starts after next week because schools start early. And so it's really the very, very last week of summer that they're coming. And that's a nice thing. I think it'll be nice for them.
Well, we understand there's a looming controversy. The Obama family will be going up island in Chilmark. Cell phone service is pretty spotty there.
People, that is correct.
People there do not want cell phone towers in their
pristine area. They do not.
It's
spotty to non-existent.
Right.
There was a request from Verizon to the Chilmark selectmen last week to put a tower up at Peaked Hill. They call it a temporary tower. Well, yes, this caused quite a stir because Chilmark doesn't have a cell tower. And the selectman, very independent, very Yankee town, said, we'll take it under advisement.
Right. And there was an interesting comment from one of the townspeople there. they don't think it's for the White House, right?
I'm pretty sure that it's not for the White House, because the White House, I think, has taken care of all the...
You'd like to think that President Obama could make a phone call without a tower, that they've got some sort of way for him to communicate.
Doesn't the Army Signal Corps come in and help him with that? I think it was for the press corps. I have a recommendation. There's a payphone at Ali's General Store, which is several hundred yards down the road. I think it might be getting a lot of use.
Julie Wells, editor of the Vineyard Gazette, talking to us about how the island is bracing for a visit from the First Family. Julie, thanks so much.
Thanks, Robin.
And just a reminder, tomorrow we're going to try to answer questions about Obama's proposed health care reform. If you have questions, go to our website, hereandnow.org. You can click on Contact Us and put them right there. We're getting many of them from you, so please feel free to do that. Up next, the business climate in Baghdad. That's in 30 seconds, Here and Now. One of the headlines out of Iraq today is a gunfight that erupted following yet another bank robbery in Baghdad. According to news reports, four men used Interior Ministry IDs to gain access to the bank. Once inside, they forced employees into a room at gunpoint. When the robbers left the bank, they were met by Iraqi police and surrendered after a gunfight. One of the bank employees also arrested. She's suspected of working with the robbers. So, life in Baghdad is challenging, and you might wonder why someone would open a nightclub there. Our next guest has done just that. His name is Akil. He'll be speaking in Arabic. Our intern, Huda Ahmed, who was a correspondent for McClatchy newspapers in Iraq when she lived there before leaving the country to come to the U.S., she will translate. Akil, you obviously don't want us to use your last name for security reasons. That would suggest that running a nightclub in Iraq today is risky.
That's true, and that's exactly what I wanted to request.
Well, Akil, we're seeing quotes in Aswad al-Iraq, the independent Reuters media outlet. Iraqis saying that nightclubs are going to lead to the spread of disease like AIDS, that they're going to lead to rapes and crime. Do you hear this from Iraqis? Do you hear from people who are critical of the clubs?
You never heard any Iraqis complaining or saying that this will spread AIDS or diseases or rape or crimes. He said, I never heard any of such thing happened in the nightclubs ever. It happened before in the Baghdad colleges and universities that, you know, women got raped, but not in the nightclubs. I haven't heard of that before.
Well, Akil, I guess I was thinking more that other people are saying that, and I know you opened kind of secretly. So what are you worried about? What are the security issues you are worried about? Are you worried someone is going to attack the club, and why would they do that?
We do a thorough check for our clients. It doesn't matter if he is a government official, if he is a high-rank official in the government, or a regular ordinary citizen. They all going to submit to a full, thorough checkup, and also they have to surrender their weapons to us. Also, their cars going to be checked thoroughly before they park. But we haven't faced any suicide bombing or any threats yet.
Well, thankfully. But Akil, what would your concerns be? Would your concerns be a political attack of some kind, or someone who might attack the club on moral grounds?
The security measures that I take for our business is not for moral or for political reasons. It's just because we want to keep ourselves safe and also our clients. And these kind of security procedures are taken over all over Iraq. If you go anywhere in Iraq, you will be subjected to these kind of security checkups.
Yeah. Well, what happens in the club, Akil? Did you have to get a license? Do you serve liquor? And what else happens there?
The nature of our nightclub is it is a restaurant during the day, and it is a nightclub during the night. Of course, we deal with all kinds of alcohols, and for the license, we can get it from tourism police. And we also have entertaining shows in the nightclub, and we used to be opened from 8 p.m. until 12 a.m. But now we got orders from the government to be open from 8 p.m. until 11:30 p.m.
Tell us more about the shows. We understand you have belly dancing.
We have males and female singers. They sing countryside songs.
Iraqi songs.
Iraqi songs, but these kind is not pop songs. They are traditional songs. That's what most of the Iraqis like. And we have female dancers that they dance belly dancing besides serving alcohol.
It sounds lovely. What do Iraqis who come say it does for them?
They come because they have, you know, like problems. They are like frustrated, stressed. So they come to our nightclub to have some fun and forget about their problems. And once they start drinking, they feel so happy and they get out and they say, hey, we are going to come back again and also we're going to bring in new customers with us. And they always like thank me for opening this business for them. And they say that we're going to come often.
It's something so simple in other countries. But do any of your clients ever say that it's much bigger than just fun? Do they see it as a human right?
After all these atrocities, wars, and violence and killings, Iraqis believe that this is one of the simplest of their human rights, is to go out and to go to these places, entertain themselves, dress up like everybody else, entertain themselves, feel happy. So they feel this is their right after all they've been through to entertain themselves.
And one last question. What do you say to politicians or other Iraqis who say drinking, dancing, what you do there is immoral?
Every person, whether he's a secular or politician or religious person, has the right to have his own opinion. So whether they agree or disagree, this is their own opinion, and I have nothing to say about it. But as long as I have my clients coming and feeling happy, entertaining, and having fun, that's their simplest rights.
That last voice was that of our intern, Huda Ahmed, translating from Arabic into English while we spoke with Akil, a businessman in Iraq who owns a nightclub in Baghdad. Somewhere there's music, I'll paint the tune. Well, we want to note the passing of Les Paul. Les Paul influenced generations of guitarists. He changed the course of music with the electric guitar and multi-track recording and had a string of hits, many with his wife Mary Ford. We're listening to How High the Moon. According to Gibson Guitar, Paul died of complications from pneumonia at White Plains Hospital in New York, family and friends by his side. In February 2006, he won two Grammys for an album he released after his 90th birthday. Let's listen a little more to Les Paul and Mary Ford, How High the Moon. Les Paul and Mary Ford. Mary passed away in 1977. Les Paul died today at the age of 94. Back with another generation of guitarists in 1 minute, Here and Now.
Support for Here and Now comes in part from the Rockefeller Foundation and its campaign for American workers. More at rockfound.org.
Welcome back to Here and Now. This week, the Los Angeles Film Festival premiered the new Spike Lee film, Passing Strange, the Movie, which will be available to cable TV viewers later this month. Passing Strange, the Movie is based on Passing Strange, the Broadway musical, which won the Tony Award for Best Book of a Musical last year, and also introduced an unlikely Broadway star. You don't know me and I don't know you. So let's cut to the chase, the name is Stu. And I'll be narrating this gig, so just sit tight. We might play all night. Stu a.k.a. Mark Stewart, is the frontman for the L.A.-based indie band The Negro Problem, and he's the co-author and lead performer of Passing Strange. The show is the loosely autobiographical story of Stu's travels from Los Angeles to Amsterdam and Berlin, with experiments in sex, drugs, and rock and roll along the way. When we spoke with Stu last year, we learned that he viewed Passing Strange as more of a rock concert than a Broadway show. Here's that conversation. A play with this band tells you how it's at. You have said that the most terrifying combination of words in the English language is rock musical. Why is that?
Because what people have called a rock musical, at least as long as I've been aware of them, has been something that features music that no self-respecting rock fan would ever listen to. You know, our goal was to take the music that we actually play with our band in the clubs and just take that actual music and put it on the American musical stage without any watering down or without any compromises. And I'm blessed to entertain. The crowd laughs and swoons. It's loud guitars and champagne. And I sleep well past noon. But I've got a lot to explain to myself, not to you. Like who lost track of her pain while working their wound.
Let's switch to the autobiographical part, the loosely autobiographical part.
What we call autobiographical fiction.
Ah, yeah. And so were you a black man in L.A., a young black man growing up in L.A.?
That's been confirmed, yes.
Yes.
That has been confirmed. Beyond that, every single thing that happens in this play, I can tell you the actual sort of real-life situation that inspired it. But it didn't necessarily happen exactly the way we present it on the stage.
Huh. Did you reject a conservative Baptist family background?
Absolutely. My family wasn't all that conservative, but I certainly rejected that world that I was asked to buy into, starting with probably 8 or 10 years old, you know, going to church every week. And I knew pretty early on that that was not going to be a part of my world, even though that was the world that my mother would have liked me to, you know, enter into.
Hmm. Well, in fact, let's listen to the Baptist Fashion Show. It's one of the earlier songs in Passing Strange when there's still a young man in Los Angeles rejecting the church. Let's listen. Mama says you gotta go to the Baptist Fashion Show. Holy war on Sunday morning. It was war on Sunday morning. Well, from Los Angeles, where it's obviously not working, the young man in Passing Strange, referred to simply as the youth, makes his way to Amsterdam. Now, you're the narrator of the whole performance. As we heard, you introduced yourself as Stu, and you're narrating this. Are you the youth? Who's the youth?
The youth is everybody from me to James Baldwin, Josephine Baker, any person who ever left their home in order to search for something that they thought was more real than where they came from. So it's a composite.
Yeah. The young man leaves Los Angeles and arrives in Amsterdam. Let's listen. Amsterdam, spring sunshine. Amsterdam, spring sunshine. Is that how you felt, Stu, when you arrived in Amsterdam from L.A.?
Yeah, I mean, I think I felt like that every time I arrived in, like, any new place. But, yeah, I mean, Amsterdam is sort of like a, it appears, at least, from that kid's vantage point, you know, kind of like a utopian world, you know. All the things that he was told were vices and sins and all the things that were illegal and done undercover were suddenly being done right out in the open in cafes and in the streets, and that's, for him, that classic sort of line, you're like, everything I know is wrong. Do you know what I mean? Everything they told me I couldn't do, everything they told me that was wrong to do, everyone here is doing it. And, like, not killing each other. It's your first time. Does it show? I'm like an ice cube gone to melt. I hope you find yourself at home. I like the cards that I've been dealt. And how's your mind? Oh, it's blown. It's a vibe I've never felt. Welcome to Amsterdam.
But the euphoria doesn't last.
No, I think that's the nature of euphoria, isn't it?
Yeah. You can have too much of that
fleeting.
Good thing. Right. I want to ask you, before we move on to Berlin, all the voices we're hearing in the cast are black actors. They play black and white characters, straight and gay characters, American, European. Was that a casting decision, or did it just happen that way?
We started out with just interracial casting because we wanted to see how that would work, and that didn't work. And then all of us at the same time looked at each other and said, let's just make it like The Wizard of Oz. Let's just make it, you know, the people he grows up with initially, who are black people, let's just have those people follow him around all the time. And then, of course, the sort of, you know, devil may care kind of approach to casting ended up, of course, like all these kind of mistakes and accidents, it ended up having meaning, because the whole play is about masks and adopting masks and picking them up and dropping them, and what is authentic and what isn't. And so actually having black characters play white people actually ended up being like a central aspect of the play, even though it definitely wasn't written that way.
Well, in fact, let's listen to a song that touches on the issue of race. It's called The Black One. Let's listen.
Who lends the club that speakeasy air? The black one, the black one. Who dances like a god and has wunderbar hair? Der Schwarze.
Is this something, Stu, that you felt as a black from Los Angeles in Berlin?
Oh, there's no question. I went to Berlin with two other black guys and a couple of Jewish guys. And yeah, we were objectified all over the place, you know. Sometimes sometimes in a good way, you know, and sometimes in a bad way, you know. But, you know, ultimately, yeah, it was something, you know, to go from just being just another guy on the street to suddenly being, like, you know, romanticized and glorified and objectified because of your skin color was quite a interesting thing.
He's doing the same thing,
except I call the surface me.
He's dancing in a cage,
but I'm the one with the key.
And he's the black one.
All of us are just constantly, you know, whether we admit it or not, we're always thinking about the demographic of whatever room we're sitting in, you know, or whatever party, or people always ask us, oh, is your audience diverse? How's your audience at Broadway? Well, what do you mean, how's the audience? And what everyone really means is, you know, well, how many black people show up? You know what I mean?
How do you feel about, though, that you might be, you talk about the great white hope on the great white way. Do you find more minorities and young people?
Do yes,
coming?
We do. Yeah. Absolutely do, yes. From what I've been told, because I don't go to Broadway shows, so I really don't know who goes to Broadway shows, but they tell me that our crowd is alarmingly diverse, and not just black people, but like lots of different people of color and younger people, obviously, who have heard that we actually have actual music.
Yeah.
We gotta fill the void with music.
That was Stu, co-creator of the musical Passing Strange. We spoke last year. The play has closed, but Stu has apparently developed an affinity for theater. He scored a performance of Shakespeare's A Midsummer Night's Dream and will be performing Broadway standards, including, we hear, Oklahoma as a samba, in a show called The Broadway Problem, which premieres next week, along with Spike Lee's film of Stu's Broadway play, Passing Strange. It's called Passing Strange, the movie. Busy guy. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston in association with the BBC World Service and PRI. I'm Robin Young. Please join us again, Here and Now.
I'll grow colder, I'll grow bolder, I'll grow older and keep filling my cup. I'll grow colder, I'll grow bolder, I'll grow older, but I'll never grow up. And this is not a